This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Wedding season is just around the corner, a time of love, excitement, and high hopes for the future. And it's a time to reflect on the institution of marriage itself, what it means to Americans today. The past few years have seen new data emerge surrounding marriage. The patterns show a changing attitude toward getting hitched. For example, the rate of people going to the altar has steadily declined since the 1980s. Today, only about 50% of adults are married, compared to 72% a half century ago. Also, couples tying the knot are increasingly older, better educated, and tend to marry within their same social class. Marriage thrives among college grads, but fares much worse among couples with less education. Today in The Exchange, we're sorting through all these trends to see what it means for those saying I do or I don't, and for American society at large. Let's hear from you this hour. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Betsy Stevenson is with us. She's Associate Professor of Public Policy and Economist at the University of Michigan. She's written about marriage and studied the institution. And Betsy, it's great to have you. Thank you for your time.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Eli Finkel. He's a professor in the psychology department and in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University in Boston. He's researched the topic of marriage. And Eli Finkel, good to have you too. Thanks for being with us.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And also with us, Mary Jo Brown, founder and president of Brown & Company Design and chair of the New Hampshire Women's Foundation. She's also owner and publisher of Seacoast Weddings magazine. And Mary Jo, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, to everybody but you first, Mary Jo, you know, we've shifted from an era not that long ago, as I said, where most adults were married. That was the norm. To an era where it is perfectly normal not to be married. So given this, Mary Jo, who is still choosing to get married these days?
So here in New Hampshire, we know that we're an incredibly well-educated state with high incomes, and that may be part of the stats that we see here. In New Hampshire, we do follow the national trends. We see that less people are getting married. We see that people are marrying later. So in the 60s, the age for women marrying was 20. Now it's closer to 26, and I think it's 26.8 in New Hampshire. We know that people are having children later, but we also know that in New Hampshire, we happen to be more of a traditional state, as I might describe it, that we have fewer single people than the national average, much fewer, actually.
Really?
Yes, much fewer. And then we have fewer single, we have a little diversity in the state, obviously. This is important, but this diversity is growing. And we probably have many more examples of what I would describe as the traditional family model here in the state.
Interesting. So is that partly because we're less of an urban state and urban areas is where single people tend to congregate?
The rural aspect of our state does play a role, but also, again, as I mentioned, simply that we are highly educated and we have higher incomes.
And that, again, as we'll talk about, there's an economic divide that people see in marriage trends that's growing. So we'll definitely cover that. So as a higher income state, that would make sense. Do you want to jump back in, Mary Jo?
Yeah, I also want to say that we have a lot of women working in the state. So we have higher numbers of women that are educated in New Hampshire and higher numbers of women who are actually the breadwinner in the marriage relationship. So those will play a role in what we talk about today as well.
Well, Eli Finkel, you've looked at this. Who's getting married today?
Yeah, Mary Jo is right. We're seeing a lot of these sorts of trends. One of the interesting features is that it's difficult to figure out the extent to which fewer people are marrying or the extent to which everybody's marrying later. So a lot of the stats that we see about how many people are single today versus in the past, do things like, well, we surveyed women age 15 to 44, and we find that many fewer of them are married today than they were in the 1950s, for example. But if it's true, and it is true, that people are marrying much later, then that stat really isn't all that meaningful. As I can best understand the evidence here, and it's actually complicated to discern it, I think higher SES people, higher socioeconomic status people, are marrying at about the same rates as in the past, but they tend to be marrying later. People who have who are of lower socioeconomic statuses tend both to be marrying later, and ultimately more of them will never marry. And to some degree, we're seeing an interesting contrast with, for example, Western Europe, where marriage rates really are plummeting. In America, marriage rates are plummeting a whole lot less than they are in much of the West.
So in terms of looking at, which number to look at, Eli, would a better number to look at be the sort of ever married rate? That's what people call it.
I think so. The tricky part is that you need to wait until people die to be able to determine that one. And so it's harder to know. That's why I'm distilling the best evidence that I can to say that I think among higher SES people, the ultimately marry ever in their life rate, I don't think is dropping that much. I think the major trend among the higher educated is to marry much later, and then I think you're seeing both trends among the less educated.
Okay, and again, SES is socioeconomic status. Betsy Stevenson, what do you think is the right way to look at this question of marriage in America today?
Well, let me start with an optimistic note. So the idea that people are marrying later than ever is completely true. And I remember when I was young, a fantastic Newsweek headline that told women over 40 that they had a better chance of being killed by a terrorist than getting married.
I remember that. That caused a big outcry, didn't it, Betsy? Go ahead.
Right. And part of the problem with that headline, I mean, aside from the sensationalism of it, was also they were looking backwards at old data. And they were looking back at a period, 1950, the typical woman married at age 20. That means half of women married by age 20. So it was a period where people married very young. That's why the people who hadn't married by age 40 weren't very likely to. Today, women and men are more likely than ever to enter a first marriage in their 40s, their 50s, and even their 60s. And so we do see people, that people marrying later. Now, the median, half of people now are still marrying by about age 28. So you can see right there, that's a big difference. So if you look at the percent married, as Eli mentioned, between 15 and I can't remember what the upper bound was, like 35, you're going to see a big difference when the age of first marriage has moved for the typical person from 20 to 27 or 28. So that is part of what's going on. But in recent research, I saw some estimates trying to project those trends. And Eli's exactly right. We have to wait till people die to know what's actually going to happen, or wait till they live their lives. But some estimates suggest that eventually around 90% of people will ultimately marry.
So 90%, Betsy.
The doomsday predictions don't seem to be panning out. And that's because we're seeing these marriages at older rates making up for the not getting married at younger rates. Now, the one thing I am seeing in the data is that people are not entering second marriages as readily as they used to. So sort of burnt once, forget it, I know how to do the relationship thing without entering a marriage again. And we are seeing a big drop-off, even though they're partnering and they're living together. So it's not a decrease in people coming together and forming lives together. It's just this decision to enter a second marriage seems to be people seem to be more reluctant to do that.
So, Betsy, in terms of that, ever married, what Eli said, we have to really wait until people die to measure this because people get married at all different phases of life. You're saying 90% of Americans will still at some point be married?
Well, I am saying that looking at some recent research, which tried to project the demographic trends, that was the number they came up with. So economic demographers Shelley Lemberg, Robert Pollack, and Jenna Stearns found that 90% of people will eventually marry, and the rates don't actually differ that much across educational groups.
Okay.
But again, these are projections, and we don't know how people are ultimately going to live their lives, because what these are trying to do is say, well, if people continue to enter these first marriages at the rates that they, if we continue to see the kind of growth we've seen in people entering first marriages at older ages, then this is what we'll get to. But of course, people could do something different.
Well, here's the big question, and I'm going to turn to you first, Mary Jo, but I want to hear from everybody. So we're hearing about the rates at which people get married and when and all these shifts. Why are people still getting married?
Oh, dear, I didn't have an answer for that. I had why they weren't. I just need to admit that by the end of the show, I'd like to know what the statistical likelihood is of me getting married. I'm 50, never married, single mother by choice, that owns a wedding magazine. So there you go. Here we are in New Hampshire.
So why aren't they then?
So one of the things that I think is very interesting that we look at the New Hampshire Women's Foundation is how the primary gender roles, the traditional gender roles of male as breadwinner and female as homemaker are breaking down. So ultimately, we know we've seen incredible shifts in this. We know that more women are working than ever before. And we know that both men and women have many more options available to them. And when I look at some of the Pew research that I see coming out and we understand what millennials think about, they're prioritizing differently. They may say, yes, I would like a career before a marriage. And as a matter of fact, there's even data that shows that they separate parenting from marriage, that they may put parenting as a higher priority than marriage. So I think that we're seeing a cultural shift and a generational shift. And we've got to remember that more women than ever are in the workforce. And that's really changing the landscape of how we put together those partnerships, marriage in particular.
Well, and you're tapping into something that I read a lot about yesterday. And Ile, I'll turn to you. I have read that instead of seeing marriage as a cornerstone of adulthood, you know, I get married and then I start to build my life, quote unquote, more and more people are seeing marriage as a capstone. I figure out my career, I maybe buy a house, I sort of establish myself, and then if it's all going well, I'll get married. What do you think about that, cornerstone versus capstone, Ile?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence in support of that idea is convincing. That's an idea that was really espoused by Andy Cherlin, a demographer and sociologist. And yes, the idea is that, you know, if we take the 1950s as a benchmark, and there's all sorts of problems with doing that, but if we take the 1950s as a benchmark, as Betsy was observing, the average woman was married at 20, the average man was married at 22. This was a first step en route to adulthood, right? You hadn't really figured out career stuff yet. You hadn't really figured out financial stability yet. It was something that you were going to get married and then figure out as a pair how you were going to navigate the rest of those transitions. And yes, these days marriage feels more optional to people. People tend to pursue their education. They tend to try to develop some type of career-related and financial stability to the degree that they can. And meanwhile, they're involved in relationships. It's not like they're holding off on dating. They're not holding off on having sex, but they're holding off on getting married. And it's something that increasingly is the sort of capstone as you've transitioned to adulthood. And one of the thought I wanted to mention with regard to your previous question is my reading, too, is consistent with Betsy's, that about 90% of Americans are likely to marry. And two things worth keeping in perspective on that, especially in terms of this capstone idea, is first, that's lower than it was in the 50s. In the 50s, we now know that 95% of people who came into adulthood in the 50s married. So the unmarried group has doubled from 5% to 10%. And again, I think it's worth keeping in mind that if you compare us to, you know, peer nations, other sort of Western nations, lots of European nations, the respect for the institution of marriage in America is enormous. It's much, much higher here than it is overseas.
Again, the phone number for you to join us this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're asking, why get married? It's a question many more Americans are asking themselves these days as people delay marriage or put it off indefinitely. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Have you yourself delayed marriage or decided against it altogether? What factors are affecting your decision? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So we asked that question on Facebook, have you delayed marriage or decided against it altogether? And here's what Nicole told us. She said, decided against it altogether. I have yet to see a marriage where people didn't give up a big chunk of their identity, be it careers or freedoms or friends or what have you, and for what? To make sure you're never alone? Nicole says that's just sad. If you're going to have kids, then yes, get married. But if not, I don't see the point. Nicole, thank you very much for the Facebook comment. And there's a couple things that she raises. Betsy, first to her point about, you know, marriage means giving up, in her words, a big chunk of your identity. Is that how a lot of young people see it?
Well, let me, as an economist, give you a little bit of a sense of how I see the marriage changing. And the, you know, this idea you raised about capstone versus cornerstone, a very famous economist who won a Nobel Prize for describing marriage as basically a little factory where we are able to produce more together by coming together and supporting each other. And so you want to do that at the beginning of your life. And what we saw was couples being able to achieve their career goals, being able to achieve their education goals by giving each other the support that they needed. And by, I mean, when I say support, I mean, production support. So wives would often work when the men were, when their husbands were in school. And what we saw was not couples where both of them were in school at the same time, but where there was sequential investment in education. And you would want to find somebody who was almost the opposite of you, who had a different set of skills, because finding somebody who was your complement would help you be more productive together as a unit. Now, what we've seen happen is that the economy has developed so much that a lot of what we need, we can get in the market. So technological change and market development means that we can borrow money to go to school instead of relying on a spouse. We can buy clothes instead of relying on a spouse who's learned how to sew. We can buy a lot of pre-cooked food instead of relying on an expert spouse chef. So that's really changed the nature of marriage. And what people are looking for now more is companionship. And I think the education example really sort of shows this, that even when couples are married and they're pursuing education, they're more likely to both be pursuing education rather than one of them pursuing education while the other one is supporting them. So there's this idea that today what we're looking for is someone who is complementary to us, someone who likes the same stuff and so likes to do the same things, and that gives us more enjoyment out of our day. If we buy a big screen TV and we like watching the same shows as our spouse, we get we get double the enjoyment from the single big screen TV. So this idea that there are things we share together, and that's really where marriage has gone today. But what that means is marriage is most beneficial when you are a bit more established in your career, where you know who you are, when you know what are the types of things you're going to want to do, because you find a spouse who likes to do those kind of things too.
Mary Jo, what do you think about Nicole's comments? Either her feeling that when you get married, you give up a big chunk of your identity, as she put it, or her second point, if you're going to have kids, then yes, get married. But if not, I don't see the point. Now, this gets to your own situation.
Sure. You know, one thing I kept thinking when she was listing the statistics is, when will we talk about love? Are we marrying for love? You know, companionship, partnership. It's interesting. So the roles that people play in their marriages really have shifted. We talk about that. And this concept of complementary partnerships is very interesting. Ultimately, in the New Hampshire Women's Foundation's listening sessions that we ran, where we're privately hearing from people about their marriages, unfortunately, we did hear a lot of people talking about what they give up. So that even if the woman earns more than the man, they moved for his job, so that they're trying to say, hey, gosh, my husband isn't comfortable babysitting the children. I mean, that's hard. So I think there are many ways in which we have to navigate and understand how they work as a team in a marriage and what roles they do play. Very practical. I know, not about love.
A lot more to talk about in just a moment. You can give us a call to 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, why Americans are waiting longer to get married, if at all. We invite you to call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we are asking the question, why get married in an era when it is not expected as it once was? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Betsy Stevenson, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Economist at the University of Michigan, Eli Finkel, Professor in the Psychology Department and in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, and Mary Jo Brown, Founder and President of Brown & Company Design, Chair of the New Hampshire Women's Foundation, owner and publisher of Seacoast Weddings magazine. And Eli, to you first, please. So what do you think about this question of why? We talked about who's getting married and who isn't. Why do people who do get married still choose to do so?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many answers to this, one of which is, as I noted previously, there's really a lot of respect for the institution in this country. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the decline in marriage. Betsy and her colleagues have shown that the divorce rate is, in fact, dropping and has been dropping for some decades now. But also, if I could tie your current question back to Nicole, the listener who said that it was just sad to make sacrifices for your partner, I'm not sure everybody agrees with her, and I actually find her worldview a little sad. You know, there's a lot that goes into living a fulfilling and meaningful life, and some of it is, in fact, making sacrifices and supporting people who love us. And she seems to have a worldview that I think is common. I certainly don't mean to pick on her, that there's something violent to the nature of selfhood to the idea of making sacrifices. And I don't actually share that view. I do think it's troubling if women are always sacrificing their careers in order to promote the careers of men or some sort of systematic bias like that. But who would want a life where you didn't have the sort of close, intimate relationships where you knew that you were the first line of defense, that your loved one was going to run into some troubles or really need support or want to celebrate, and that you were the one that he or she was going to turn to when those opportunities arose, and that it was going to be a reciprocal relationship in that way. And I think a lot of people are looking for something like that from marriage, and I'm delighted that they are.
So you would say, Eli, don't just look at what you're quote-unquote giving up. Look at what you gain in that sacrifice.
That is exactly right. In general, not only do I think giving up, that the ratio of giving up to getting is probably pretty good on average in marriage, but that thinking about sacrificing only in negative terms is problematic. I mean, supporting others, being a part of something, a lifelong commitment, or even if it's not totally lifelong, being a part of something that you care about and value and want to nurture, even at the expense of you giving up some of your time or other things that you value, I mean, that's not an unmitigated bad, and in some ways is actually quite a lovely thing.
Let's hear from our listeners, and then there's so much more to talk about. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Give us your thoughts about the state of marriage in America today, whether you're married or not, whether you plan to get married, whether you plan to avoid marriage. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And Lisa is calling from West Dummerston, Vermont. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for being on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was married at a young age, 22, out of college, and in 1962. And I think that there were sacrifices and trade-offs, and there were tough times and so forth. But now, at the age of 75, it's payoff time of being a grandmother of three and having the energy left to really love being a grandmother and being able to really give and be involved with my grandchildren.
And how do you think your children feel about marriage, Lisa? Do they have a different attitude from you getting married so young in the 1960s?
Yes, they do. One is living with someone and not, and the other is my son is very married with the three grandchildren.
So one is living with someone and not married. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's taken some, you know, adjustment, but I think the high divorce rate is a reason that that's being avoided, and I can totally get that.
Well, Lisa, it's great to hear from you. Congratulations on those grandkids, by the way. What do you think about some of the points she makes, Mary Jo?
I just loved hearing your call, Lisa. I loved that you love being a grandparent. It's interesting because I think that, you know, relating to Eli's point and Lisa's point, I want to make sure I mention that in owning a wedding magazine over the past 20 years, I've seen nothing but that industry grow, the admiration for marriage as an institution grow. I've seen older people getting married, certainly. I'm very proud to say that we've seen several gay marriages in the wedding, which I love, and I'm proud of the state for honoring that, the gay marriage institution. And what I do see is that couples are approaching the institution with a lot of creativity in perhaps a more unique way than we used to see. So perhaps Lisa, as she went from a more traditional situation where she felt like she gave something up, has now aged and is able to see a different cultural situation, which is incredible. I talked to a couple yesterday who said that when they were first married, they each filled much more traditional roles in their marriage. But as they aged and communicated together, he's now doing the cooking, she's now working, and that they've grown with each other and changed over time.
Well, and I came across a statistic yesterday that I think almost 30% of wives make more than their husband. So, well, that's another dynamic.
And that's accurate for New Hampshire as well. A couple of years ago in 2013, the big number was 4 in 10 households now have the female as the lead breadwinner. That is extremely substantial. And in many ways, we have to think about what that means for those marriages. So ultimately, if the male was considered the breadwinner in the home and no longer is, what does that mean for that partnership, that relationship? What identities does that male then have in that particular relationship?
Well, Lisa, again, thank you for the call. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And an economic question for you, Betsy, but I want to hear from everyone. There's been a lot of data lately about this marriage gap that two groups are emerging, as we've been talking about, people who are better educated in that higher economic status group do seem to be getting married. But more and more I'm reading, Betsy, that lower income folks are not getting married. How come?
Well, what we have seen is that we've discussed people are getting married at older ages, and for higher educated women, that also means having their children at later ages. And I was extremely sympathetic to the caller. I think right after my first child was born when I was 38, I thought, oh no, what have I done? I will be so old as a grandmother. There are costs to it, but there are also benefits, which is that one of the big predictors of divorce is age of first marriage. So marrying at a very young age is very associated with a higher likelihood of divorcing. And so what we see is more highly educated women are postponing both marriage and postponing childbirth. And so you see them being more likely to be in sort of what looks like traditional. I say what looks like traditional because they're not traditional in the sense that the women are working. The women are often earn more than the husband, but they are, households with, two kids and a dog and a husband and wife who are married. And, you see a lot of that, particularly among highly educated folks in their 30s. What we see with less educated women is that they are postponing marriage, but they're not postponing childbirth. And that really complicates and changes their relationship with marriage, because now they're approaching marriage with children already, typically with children who come from whose fathers are not the ones that they're currently involved in, and that's really is creating a gap in not just marriage but the family dynamics that are occurring among people with more education compared to people with less.
Give us a little bit more there, Betsy, if you could. What do you mean family dynamics among those lower income families where people are choosing not to get married?
Well, you know, you're seeing that there's, you know, often children are in households with adults who are not their biological parent. They may have a sibling who shares a different parent than they have. And they're more likely to be raised by, you know, a single mom. So that, you know, what I think a lot of women learn once they become single moms is that, you know, that's kind of a state that is not necessarily conducive to focusing on a brand new relationship. And so I think you're seeing a lot of women in that who have chosen to have children first then find that perhaps marriage is more difficult to enter into after they've made that choice.
And you're an economist, Betsy. What are the economics of these single-parent households?
Well, a lot of people think that, you know, people need to be married in order to have higher household income. But as I discussed earlier, you know, marriage has moved away from being something that's really about producing more together and one that's more about shared consumption. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's more, it is more popular today among people with more income, because they have the time and the income and the resources to really enjoy marriage. The group of women who were the least likely to marry in the past were women with a college degree. Women with a college degree were very unlikely to marry at a time in which there were traditional gender roles in marriage, because once women were choosing that they were going to pursue education and perhaps a career, the model of marriage that was popular didn't really fit for them. They weren't going to be a specialist in home production. They wanted to get out into the workforce. And that meant that college-educated women were highly unlikely to marry in the 1950s, 1960s, and even 1970s. And today, college-educated women are the most likely to marry, and that's because we do have this changing model of marriage where people come together who are going to share things rather than necessarily doing it for the financial reasons. And if you look at survey data, even though we see these highly educated couples who are married do have a lot more income, if you ask them why they're marrying, financial stability is not at the top of their list. So it's the fact that financial stability is no longer the primary driver for marriage that is leading to this difference by socioeconomic status, not that this difference by socioeconomic status is necessarily the cause behind financial differences in financial stability.
That's really interesting, though, Betsy. And Eli, I wonder what you think, the idea that college-educated women used to be the last ones to get married because they didn't want to, in Nicole's words, give something up. But now this is the group that is getting married.
Yeah, I mean, Betsy's correct. A lot of this has to do with the changing nature of the institution of marriage. Even in the last 50 years, we've seen a pretty significant update in what people are looking for from the marriage. Yes, people in the 50s and 60s were looking for some amount of love and companionship from the marriage, and they certainly still are looking for those things now, even more so in the sense that socializing used to be more sex segregated. You can think about like the Elks Club, for example. But the other factor is that people are increasingly looking to marriage as a means of self-expression, as a means of figuring out, like, who am I and what's the best version of myself and how can I live a life that affords the expression of that best version of myself. And education is helpful as people try to figure that out for themselves and as they try to figure it out for each other. Of course, as we're talking about what's going on with the higher socioeconomic status groups, we can also talk about the lower socioeconomic status groups. And I think one of the issues for the lower marriage rates for the lower socioeconomic groups is this capstone idea. If you look at how much higher and lower socioeconomic status groups value the institution of marriage, you might expect to see that lower, less educated people, for example, value the institution less. After all, they're marrying less, they're divorcing more. But you don't see anything like that. They value the institution every bit as much, if not more, than higher socioeconomic status individuals. And if you ask across the socioeconomic spectrum, what factors do you think are important in a good marriage, there's there's widespread consensus across, you know, wealthy people, poor people, and everyone in between about what makes for a good marriage. So one of the major issues confronting the lower socioeconomic status members of our society is this capstone idea that in contrast to the 50s, 60s, 70s, where, say, a high school educated guy could get a job and support a family of four, those sorts of jobs are mostly gone. And so the ability to achieve the basic levels of financial stability that we look for in adulthood before we marry, those are increasingly hard to find among the lower socioeconomic status groups. And of course, we've also had a pretty significant incarceration tendency in this country relative to pretty much any other country in the world. And those are systematically oriented toward people with less education as well. So I think those are a couple reasons why we're seeing, you know, very positive trends about how marriage is going among the wealthier and better educated. And we're seeing trends in the opposite direction among the poorer and the less educated.
Well, what you just said, Eli, relates to another Facebook comment we got from Shannon to our question of, you know, have you delayed marriage or decided against it? What factors affected your decision? And Shannon says on Facebook, probably because we can't afford it. So there you have it. So it's kind of sad, Mary Jo, that, you know, what Eli says, that people, if you survey people in all income groups, they all value this institution. But as Eli says, for a lot of lower income Americans, it's just they don't see that they can afford it. It's a capstone to once they're all set and they don't feel all set.
Yeah. And so we can look at all that research and we can just intuitively understand that the economic pressure would be great. Right. There are so many families that have two parents working. There are so many families struggling to make ends meet. So you can imagine that the balancing act, in conjunction with the economics of it, would be pretty amazing. In New Hampshire, we have very few what I would describe as family-friendly policies in the state. So ultimately, at the New Hampshire Women's Foundation, one of our key priorities is understanding how we can better support families through family-friendly workplaces and or policies.
Which would, in the end, support marriage.
Right. So exactly. When you think about paid leave, you know, that's in the press a lot. The United States certainly has not. We're the last in all of the industrialized nations to have that policy in place. When you think about paternity leave in addition to maternity leave, when you think about the importance of minimum wage or equal pay. And in fact, New Hampshire has the highest we're like one of the highest costs of childcare in the entire United States.
We did a program on that last week. Yeah.
So those are all economics that, yes, affect marriage greatly.
Let's take another call. This is Chris in Kittery, Maine. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, panel.
Morning.
I grew up, as you can probably tell, the accent, Scotland. And I got married in 1976. My wife and I have been dating since 1972. And all my friends, we all roughly get married about the same time. You know, everybody turns 21 at the same time. You know, you've all the parties. And the main reason we get married was it was sex, it was intimacy. Because in those days, it was so frowned upon to live with each other without being married. I mean, you were, the guy was a wanton woman. You were like, oh, what kind of man are you, you know? And you just wanted to be with each other. And I think that's the main reason 70s, 60s, 50s, people wanted to be with each other so you get married young, you know? And, we waited for 5 years before our kids come along.
Well,
we had a good time, our vacations and all that stuff. And then we said, okay, let's, the kids. And my son is now, I'm 62 now. My son's 35, so...
Well, Chris, I'm going to cut you off because we're heading into a break, but we'll talk about this in just a minute. So thank you very much for calling in. The idea that now that sex outside marriage is seen as more acceptable, what does that mean for marriage? So we'll follow up, Chris, in just a second. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at why Americans are waiting longer to get married and other trends, including avoiding marriage altogether. We've also talked about the so-called marriage gap, that two groups are emerging: higher income folks, better educated folks who continue to get married at strong rates. But among lower income Americans, a drop-off of marriage. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. And Eli Finkel, I want to throw Chris's question to you. Back in the day when sex outside of marriage was seen as a no-no, he says that's why we got married. Now that seems to be more accepted. You've got young couples living together and so forth. So how does that change the idea of marriage?
Oh, he's absolutely right. I mean, marriage, it's not just sex, right? And it's not just in the last 50 years. I mean, one of the major trends, I mean, going back to the Mayflower, right? One of the major trends over the last several hundred years of marriage, certainly in America, is that the institution is becoming less and less necessary. It used to be that there was no social safety net, at least at the governmental level. It used to be that in order to survive, like the individual farmhouse was the unit of economic production, right? You were completely dependent upon a productive marriage in order to survive, or at least largely dependent in order to survive. And sex is another thing, right? Sex was, to a large extent, unavailable to people outside of marriage. But I could go down a long list of things that you needed marriage for in the past that you no longer need marriage for. And so what's happened with the institution is that it is viewed as more optional. But in America, like I said, despite the fact that it's viewed as more optional, that you don't need it to survive, you don't need it to have sexual fulfillment, most people still want it. And that, I think, is the most interesting question, right? Why is it that despite the fact that we no longer need it for economic survival, we no longer need it for sexual fulfillment and on and on and on, companionship, why is it that everybody is still marrying? And
well, that's my question for you.
Yeah.
I'm listening to you talking.
Right.
I'm going, yeah, why? If you don't need it for, you know, intimacy, if you don't need it for economic reasons, if you don't need it because society won't shame you anymore and wonder what's wrong with you, why bother?
I mean, I think it's a compelling question, and I think a lot of people are very reasonably wondering, like, why do I need this piece of paper or this certification, especially, you know, many people are marrying for religious reasons, but if we hold aside the people who are marrying for religious reasons, why do they marry? I mean, I could pose the question to myself, and the answer is, I still respect the institution. I think this is a highly a reasonable, compelling, I think exciting way to go about living my life. I think it's on average, a healthy way to go about raising children. But I do want to underscore that there's all sorts of other ways, there's all sorts of other lifestyles that are reasonable and fulfilling, right? People can cohabit without marrying. Some people don't even want to have a serious relationship, and they are highly investing in a broader group of friends. Certainly, marriage is in some sense a selfish institution. Once you marry, you see a whole lot less of pretty much everybody else except your wife and your kids or your husband and your kids. But in general, I think people remain excited about this option as a way to lead a fulfilling life. And, you know, I can speak for myself and say, so far, so good.
Well, I've got a couple emails I'd love to share with all of you. And here's one from Liz in Holderness. She says, as a financially secure, non-heterosexual woman, now legally allowed to marry my partner of nearly 15 years, Liz says, I find that my interest in marrying is even less than it was before marriage became available to me. Liz says, I still find no religious or financial institution to involve the government in my intimate relationship. I do acknowledge, she says, however, that as I get older, practical economic or healthcare reasons to marry may emerge. Liz, thank you so much for this. And I'll turn to you first, Betsy Stevenson, maybe the last part of her email, that as I get older, practical economic or healthcare reasons to marry may emerge. What do you think, Betsy? Betsy, you're still with us. Okay, we seem to have lost Betsy's line there in Michigan. Do you want to jump in on that, Mary Jo, that as you get older, there seems to have some reasons to marry?
I know. Aren't some of these comments so very practical? You know, our wonderful Scottish gentleman, I'm married to have sex, you know. And here, why would I marry? It doesn't seem to make sense. Ultimately, as the world changes, we see this institution that has so much history and so much meaning to so many people And you have to wonder where we see it as an ideal and where we see it as a practical arrangement. So I own a bridal magazine. I do see the love. I do see the starry-eyed romance in these wonderful brides and grooms, or grooms and grooms and brides that are getting married. But ultimately, I need to say that these practical considerations trump in many ways. If you go through watching several divorces where people have lost part of their estates, or you're not sure that your the assets have been divided fairly, if you experience that enough in life, that alone may be a reason not to get married. I guess there's this interesting place where we're meeting this romantic ideal of a very traditional partnership with the practical nature of the economics and role share, and, you know, the roles that we play in that marriage. It's a tough subject, actually, in many ways.
Well, and to the other part of her email, and I'll turn to Eli, she says, a financially secure, non-heterosexual woman. We've talked a lot about the trends in marriage and people avoiding marriage and divorce. Do these trends tend to hold up among same-gender couples as well, Eli, or is it different?
Well, we can't know yet. You mean about the trends in terms of marriage, per se?
Yeah, broadly.
Yeah, I mean, it's too early to know. I mean, you know, it's only become the law of the land in the last year, and even the very progressive states. I think the first state to legalize same-sex marriage, I believe, was Massachusetts in 2003. So we can't talk about trends in terms of marriage per se, but I do think it's reasonable to talk about the nature of marriage and marriage-like relationships. And in general, yes, same-sex relationships seem to be extremely similar to heterosexual relationships across a broad spectrum of psychological variables that have been investigated thus far in the social sciences. But also this sort of staggeringly rapid approval of same-sex marriage, right? Like, there was, your listeners may or may not remember that after 2003, when Massachusetts legalized it, there was a huge backlash in 2004 and 2008, and then the tide since, you know, 2010 or so just shifted with tremendous rapidity. And I think that is part and parcel of the broader trends that we're seeing about marriage and about intimate, you know, marriage-like relationships more generally, which is these are self-expressive experiences now, right? They're not obligatory social institution. Marriage, for example, is not an obligatory social institution anymore. It's something that is available to people if they choose to take advantage of it, and they probably should. The prevailing view is they probably shouldn't take advantage of it if it is, you know, bad for their psychological health and so forth. These are relatively new ideas, right? You couldn't have, in 1850, you couldn't have made the argument that, well, we're married, but he makes me feel bad about myself all the time, and so I want a divorce. That no court would have allowed that to happen. But over time, we've seen this broad increase in emphasis on psychological need fulfillment and self-expression. And the idea that we would deprive same-sex people of the opportunity to, you know, self-express and, you know, formalize their love through marriage became incompatible with the broader trend for marriage to foster these richer psychological needs. So I'm shocked by the pace at which things changed over the last 5 years in terms of same-sex marriage, but I feel like in some sense the change was inevitable because it aligns more broadly with the broader social changes that we're seeing about relationships in society at large.
Let's take another call. This is Tom in Hancock. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I've been married for almost 44 years. I got married at 22. My wife was 19. I had just graduated from college, and my wife had 2 years of college to go. She went on to get several degrees and 2 master's degrees, and I went on to get a master's degree. We have 4 sons who are all married. The youngest one got married this past September at age 33, and our second oldest son got married the year before at age 37. We have 5 grandchildren. We had 20 foster children. But I think that, you know, people don't get married today because they want more for themselves and they don't stretch themselves. They don't do as much as they can do because they're a little bit more self-centered, to be honest with you. And they want to have more before they make everything perfect, and nothing is perfect in life. And so I think that their needs make them postpone their marriages or not get married at all because they can't make commitments.
Tom, thank you so much for the comments. Lots to chew on. And Betsy Stevenson, I'll turn back to you. People today don't want to get married, he says, because they don't want to make a commitment. It's all about them. Betsy, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a toughie.
You know, that I think I would actually turn to Eli for some of that, because that's, you know, more a psychological question. But I think that, you know, there are benefits from making commitments. So to put this in the language of economics, it, you know, you don't want to invest in another person if you aren't going to be committing to them. But some of the biggest rewards from relationships come when you make investments. And, you know, those investments might seem really small, but they still are ones where they make a big difference. There are lots of investments, big and small, that, you know, you'll reap the benefits for over many, you know, many, many years. And that's why you want to make a commitment together. So, for example, you might decide that you're going to have children together. That's obviously a joint investment that you're going to be pursuing, you know, as a project with another person. So you might choose to make that kind of investment. You might even just decide you're going to learn tennis because you've found a partner who really loves to play tennis and you want to be able to play tennis with them. So one of the things that marriage does for us is it gives us a little bit more reassurances that when we make these investments, the relationship's going to be around for us to be able to reap the returns to the investment. And I think that's one of the reasons why people will continue to make commitments to each other, because there are big benefits from being able to build a relationship and invest in it, both, you know, personal benefits, but, you know, and benefits to the couple as a unit.
You know, Mary Jo, I have to ask you about this, and this is a little tricky position I'm putting you in. I apologize. But, you know, our caller, Tom, says, hey, people don't get married because they don't want to make the commitment. And, you know, nothing's perfect, but, you know, he seems to be saying, jump in and do it. It's worth it. You have chosen not to make that commitment. So I just wonder what you think about Tom's comment that people don't get married today because they are afraid to make that commitment.
I need to say that the majority of my close friends were really laughing when they heard that I was going to be on the show talking about marriage. So everyone got a big kick out of that, despite the fact that I own a bridal magazine. And I, you know, I love that caller's call. It's an incredibly great story. And I have so many friends who have incredibly successful marriages, who communicate well, who support each other's lives, who have navigated that with grace. And it's incredibly impressive. For me, I think coming from a very traditional home, it mattered a lot for me to be independent financially. So when I left school and prioritized with my career led the way there. And quite honestly, in between my 30s and 40s, I was absolutely panic-stricken because I knew I always wanted to have children, and yet I had not met the mate that I hoped to have. So did I think I would be married? Did I hope that I would be married? Absolutely. I own a bridal magazine. I love the concept of even the Disney romance, probably too much, to be quite honest. But ultimately, you know, I was turning 40. I had not found the person I would be married to, and I decided to have children with that partner that I was splitting up with at the time. So,
How many children do you have, Mary Jo?
One child, my daughter Haley, who is now 11, and like one of the other callers, one of our guests, I will be an older parent. So we're constantly doing the math. You know, I had her when I was 40. You know, and she's the greatest gift in my life. And yes, I've been in a wonderful partnership with a gentleman for 6 years, who's often on your show from the bookstore. So I struggle when I hear people saying, oh, is it because you don't like commitment? Because I'm not sure that's an accurate depiction of my personal life story. I'll also say that I never expected in this state in New Hampshire that I would stand out as much as I did. So in having role models like Murphy Brown and Gloria Steinem, I thought, gosh, I can be a single mother by choice. This is going to work and I will be accepted. And in fact, I guess I was accepted in many ways, but there was also some judgment that did happen, and I simply haven't found that many peers who can relate that much to my story here in New Hampshire.
So you're committed to your daughter.
Yes.
You're committed
I love
to
being
your
a mom.
Work.
Yes.
You're committed to your community, but you're not committed to a spouse in that traditional
way.
Well,
and I'm not married, but that doesn't mean I'm not in a committed relationship. I think that the reality is marriage for me may not be what's key there. But yes, I am in a committed relationship. I am in a committed relationship with someone who loves my daughter. And it brings great joy to my life. But yes, it's part of many commitments that I have.
Well, we really appreciate the call. And a couple emails I would absolutely love to share with you. This gets to what you just said, Mary Jo, about having children later and what that means for the grandparents. Here's someone who didn't give a name who says, our son married in his late 30s. He and his wife, who are now close to 40, just had their first child. We are excited to be grandparents. But when we think about the fact that this grandchild probably won't remember much about us before the age of 6, and by then we may be diminished, it hurts me to think that I won't be as vital a part of his life as my grandparents were in mine. My parents, like many others from that generation, were married in their 20s. So there's somebody talking about the downside of older marriage rates, older people being older when they have kids. Here's a Facebook comment from Nikki, who says, I've been engaged 4 times. I was a single mother, college educated with a career, but I didn't want to commit to someone, there's that word again, that didn't know how to balance career and family. Now, Nikki says, my son is 20 and in the Navy, and at 39, I happened to find a person that works in the same field, has kids already, and is just as committed to both career and family as I am, so I am ready. And we are having a baby. So congratulations, wow, Nikki. Thank you for the Facebook comment. Here's one more. This is from Allison. My fiance and I are getting married in 45 days, and we could not be more excited. Congratulations, Allison. We both have divorced parents, which has sparked a lot of conversation about how we will handle hardships in our marriage. I know some data shows that children who experience divorce are more likely to divorce themselves. However, I feel that because I knew the kind of divorce effects divorce had on me, I will personally want to avoid divorce at all costs. Well, Allison, good luck to you at that big event that's happening in 45 days. Thank you for the email. And to all our guests, Mary Jo Brown, Eli Finkel, Betsy Stevenson, thank you so much for being here. Betsy, thank you for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Betsy Stevenson, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Economist at the University of Michigan. Eli Finkel, it was really great to talk to you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Eli Finkel, professor in the psychology department and in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. And Mary Jo Brown, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Laura.
Mary Jo Brown, founder and president of Brown & Company Design, chair of the New Hampshire Women's Foundation. She's also owner and publisher of Seacoast Weddings magazine. This is The Exchange on NHPR.